Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC on the Ides of March. Good morning, everyone. The Ides of March, or March 15th, became notorious for the assassination of Julius Caesar, of course. No one is calling for the assassination of Donald Trump, let's be clear about that. But resistance groups are designating today the Ides of Trump. Do you know about this? And using that hashtag as they launch a massive postcard writing campaign. Not tweets, but old-fashioned cardboard postcards as they hope to flood the White House mailroom with concise gems of pithy dissent. The website Daily Kos has the headline, Be Aware, the Ides of Trump. And they post this from the Ides of Trump community page on Facebook. It says, each of us, every protester from every march, each Congress-calling citizen, volunteer, donor, and petition signer, if each of us writes even a single postcard and we put them all in the mail on the same day, March 15th, well, you do the math. So I thought some of you would like to know about that. And actually, our first guest is running a little bit late. So we can take a few minutes here at the top just to hear from any of you who might be participating in the Ides of March or Ides of Trump postcard writing campaign. Is anybody actually doing this? If you want to call in and tell me, tell everybody what you're putting on your Ides of Trump postcard, you can do that right now at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. I don't know how big a thing this is actually going to become in the world, but I know it's being passed around a lot of people's Facebook pages and resistance groups and some of the progressive news organizations. So if anybody's actually writing a postcard to Donald Trump on this Ides of Trump campaign to put in the mail today and flood the White House mailroom, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And you can shout out your text before our first guest, Paul Fishman, gets here, who's a very special guest, and I'll tell you why in a minute. But also today, here on the Brian Lehrer Show, we will look at one idea for maybe the ultimate act of resistance. Proponents call it Blue Exit. Have you heard about this one? All the blue states like New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and California, and whoever else wants to come along, secede from the United States of Steve Bannon and form their own country, either officially or unofficially. Let the Bannons have their nation, the progressives will have theirs, and nobody will have to fight anymore about basic norms of humanity and democracy and discrimination. Good idea. We will talk to a writer for The New Republic who is taking this pretty seriously in about a half hour. Also today, we'll dig into one provision of the Trump-Ryan health care plan that isn't getting much attention. Right in that bill, in addition to transforming the health insurance system, they would defund Planned Parenthood. With the media stuck in the weeds of this bill on, you know, Medicaid block grants and insurance tax credits and all of that, there's hardly been any notice that Trump and Ryan are using health reform as the vehicle for Planned Parenthood defunding now. They say the same amount of money would go to other women's health providers who don't offer abortions. So we will discuss the implications of that later in the show with a leading OBGYN physician from here in New York and another guest. And we'll hear an argument today that citing people's privilege and saying, check your privilege, all of that, is not the best way to fight for equality. We will hear that argument today. But to begin, in just a few minutes, as soon as he walks in the door, because he's running a little late, because it takes time on a day after a snowstorm and an ice storm to get here from New Jersey, we're going to talk to the outgoing U.S. attorney from New Jersey. You know how Trump demanded the resignation of all the U.S. attorneys appointed by Obama over the weekend? The U.S. attorney in Manhattan, Preet Bharara, got most of the publicity around that. But there were 45 other U.S. attorneys affected, including another big one in our area who's going to walk in here any minute, Paul Fishman. He was the U.S. attorney for New Jersey for the last 8 years until Saturday. Probably his most famous case was last year's Bridgegate trial, which we will talk about, in addition to U.S. attorney politics and Jeff Sessions politics and all of that with Paul Fishman. But while he's making – oh, is he – okay. So, well, let's get through a few of your postcards because he is walking in the door. But since we asked, Liza on the Lower East Side, you're writing a postcard for the Ides of Trump?
Hello. It's already written.
And what's on it?
All right. It says, on the front, it says, you're fired. And on the message part, it says, for bigotry and cruelty and incompetence and lying, and misogyny and racism.
Thank you very much. Leo on the Upper East Side, you're writing a postcard?
Yes, indeed. I wrote one that said, don't make a mockery of our democracy, and I put niet underneath that. And my girlfriend wrote one that said, you can fool some of the people some of the time, but you can't fool all the people all of the time. And she also put niet at the bottom. And we're part of Indivisible Upper East Side, by the way. This is not on their behalf, but why not?
Thank you very much. Brandon in Nassau County. Hi, Brandon. You're writing a postcard for the Ides of Trump?
Yes, I did. It was a picture of a cactus, and on the card I wrote, to take the prickly out of the press over Vlado Putin, remind Americans that 150 years ago on March 30th, America bought Alaska from Russia for $7.2 million. It's now worth $7.2 trillion. So chill out. Remember, they are comrades.
You wrote really small on that postcard to get all that in, right?
Let's hope that we all celebrate it. Have a great day.
Thank you, you too. Lisa in Ossining, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lisa. You wrote a postcard for the Ides of Trump?
I did, and I also took about 50 postcards and put stamps on them, and I'm passing them out to people. And I just said I'm against your ignorance, your policies, your lack of character, your incompetence, your ego, your amorality, your lies, your ties, your appointees, your spin, and your puppet master. Impeach now.
Thank you very much. Deanna in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. You wrote a postcard for the Ides of Trump?
Yes, I did. My favorite one that I wrote was, show us your taxes. But I just want to say that our little group of 12 people had a party and 60 people showed up and wrote 500-plus postcards, and it was one of the funnest and most satisfying things I've done since the election.
Thank you very much. Miles on the Upper West Side is going to get our last one as Paul Fishman is here now. Hi, Miles.
Hey, I'm just writing to Trump. I'm writing a resign in several languages, Russian, Japanese, Arabic, whatever I can get my hands on, really. So thanks a lot.
Thank you, Miles. Thanks to all of you for sharing your postcards. And now our very special guest, Paul Fishman. As I mentioned before, you know how Donald Trump demanded the resignation of all the U.S. attorneys appointed by Obama over the weekend? It was Preet Bharara, the U.S. attorney in Manhattan, or Southern District of New York, as it's known officially, who got most of the publicity around that. But there were 45 other U.S. attorneys affected, including another big one in our area, who joins me now, Paul Fishman, who is the U.S. attorney for New Jersey since 2009 until Friday or Saturday. Probably his most famous case was last year's Bridgegate trial, which we'll talk about in addition two other things. Mr. Fishman, thanks so much for coming on today. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me back, Brian.
U.S. attorneys are political appointees. Why wouldn't you and all the others appointed by President Obama have offered your resignations on day one as a matter of course?
So this was obviously a topic of conversation among the U.S. attorneys and between us and the officials in the Department of Justice after the election. There were conversations with the transition team, and we were told that we would not have our resignations requested immediately and that there would be an orderly transition. And I think all of us knew, Brian, that our time was coming to an end. We understand that these are political appointments, and the president has the right and the opportunity to appoint people to these jobs who he wants as part of his administration. And it's not, honestly, it's not about me. It's not about my wanting to hold on to this job. It's not about being a sore loser. For us, it's about making sure there's an orderly transition in the offices that we really care so deeply about, with missions that we're really involved in.
Preet Bharara, the U.S. Attorney in Manhattan, as you know, refused to resign and made them fire him. Did you consider that course of action for yourself?
I have to say, for me, it's sort of the same. My resignation was requested. I assumed they wanted me to go right away. I can't, you know, I've known Preet for a long time. We've been friends since we were nominated together in the spring of 2009. You know, his office has had some unbelievably high-profile and important cases over the almost 8 years, 7.5 years he's been the United States Attorney. And when that happens, you have lots of fans and you have some detractors. I can't tell you what happened between the time that the president asked him or told him he could stay in November and now. Obviously, something happened in the White House to change the president's mind. I haven't had a chance to catch up with Preet since Friday, but I'm looking forward to doing that later this week.
But how did you take his refusing to resign? Was he standing on some kind of principle or just making this about him to look like a tough guy when he's really in the wrong?
I'm not going to speculate about what was going on in his head. He was differently situated than the rest of us because he had actually been told or asked to stay. And so perhaps that's it. But I can't speculate about his motives for doing this.
So why do you think Trump and Attorney General Sessions changed from gradual orderly transition to precipitous demand for resignation? Until I hear otherwise, I'm assuming it was to get all the Democrats that they can out of the Justice Department as much as they can, because you're more likely to be aggressive on investigating Russia ties and other possible conflicts of interest. Yeah. That's my theory.
I think that does a little bit of a disservice to the career men and women who populate our offices and the FBI agents and other agents from other investigative agencies that work on all of those cases. I have every confidence that the work of my office, it's the one I know best, will continue exactly the way it has, unabated. Bill Fitzpatrick, who was my first assistant U.S. attorney, which is the second in command, is now the acting United States attorney. He has extraordinary judgment. He's a man of great character. I know the people in that office. And so in my office, the investigations that we have will continue. And so I don't think that will be the effect. You know, what bothered me about the precipitous of our departure is not that we were asked to go. I myself had been planning to leave sometime probably in the first week or so in May. There are two problems. One is, I think for the people who have these jobs, there's some measure of disrespect. I'll give you an example. My friend John Vaudry is the U.S. attorney in Madison, Wisconsin. He has worked for the Department of Justice for 38 years. He has not only been the U.S. attorney, he has traveled to 25 countries on 60 trips on behalf of the United States Department of Justice and the United States Department of State to teach people in those countries about the value of independent prosecutors and the rule of law. I don't know why you have to toss him out in 7 hours. Mm. Barb McQuaid, the U.S. attorney in Detroit, a mother of four, was the prosecutor of the Abdulmutallab case, the underwear bomber. She handled the case in Flint, Michigan, Takata airbags, VW, the VW police. She took on her last day in office, not knowing when it was set up that would be her last day in office. People who are giving that kind of dedicated, passionate public service should not be told that you have 7 hours to get out of your office. In addition to that, you know, as the United States attorneys, one of the principal parts of our jobs is to not only be the chief federal law enforcement officers in our districts, but also to be the face of the office, to deal with community groups and religious groups and advocacy groups and all of the law enforcement organizations, federal, state, county, local. And when you have those relationships, which are built up over, in my case, 7.5 years, what you want to do is be able to hand it off in a way that makes sense for the office, makes sense for those groups, and not sort of disappear one day. You know, when I was thinking about this, it's not how you'd run a business if you were the president. You wouldn't, if somebody leaves in 7 hours, it's usually because they did something wrong. But when the CEO of an organization is going to go, an orderly transition is almost always built in.
But if it wasn't for the political reasons that I stated in my theory, then why did they do it in this precipitous way?
I don't know the answer to that. I'm not saying it wasn't for political reasons. They may have wanted to have all the remaining Obama appointees out of the Justice Department, although that was not a decision they made in January or November.
Something. Next week rather than next month, they were afraid would happen.
They just wanted us out in a day. That's all I can say. And I think it reflects a lack of appreciation for and respect for the mission of our offices and the way, the apolitical way in which the U.S. attorneys, in my estimation, have conducted themselves throughout this administration. I had a pretty unique vantage point. In addition to being the U.S. attorney in New Jersey, I was for 5 of the 7 years I was the U.S. attorney. I was a member of what's called the Attorney General's Advisory Committee of U.S. Attorneys. It's like a board of trustees almost, picked by the Attorney General from the U.S. Attorney Corps around the country. And I was the vice chair and the chair of that organization for 3.5 years. And I got to know all of my 93 colleagues around the country. And while it is true that everybody gets these jobs through a political process, in my experience, once we got in the door, we checked our politics at the door. So I think there's a they've misestimated, if that's a word, or as President Bush once said, underestimated,
right.
Exactly what our jobs are.
U.S. Attorney until last Friday or Saturday, Paul Fishman from New Jersey, and we can take phone calls for him at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. But let me stay on that point. How political or non-political is the job of U.S. attorney, really? It can be confusing to people because as a prosecutor, all of you will say you're for non-political enforcement of the law, like you just said. But then lift the veil, and Reagan's appointee for Manhattan was Rudy Giuliani, and we know who he turned out to be. Bush's appointee for New Jersey was Chris Christie, and we see who he turned out to be. Are your politics really something that U.S. attorneys can turn on and off?
So in this particular part of the job, I think the answer to that is yes. And I can look, I'm an Obama appointee, and I think people know where I stand politically on a variety of issues. But I was the chief of the criminal division in the office that I just left for Justice Alito when he was the United States attorney. I was the first assistant for Mike Chertoff, who later went on to be both a federal court of appeals judge and the secretary of Homeland Security. They're both real Republicans, if that's a word. And I spent a lot of hours with them investigating, prosecuting, running an office. And I can tell you that while they may have had certain political views at the time, that it did not infect at all they ran the office.
Different values that can inform how a prosecutor, like a judge, all the judges on the Supreme Court, the justices will say, we are only here to uphold the Constitution as we see it. And yet you can pretty much predict how the ones who are appointed by Democrats and the ones who are appointed by Republicans are going to vote on things.
Right. But I think if you look at my record in the U.S. Attorney's Office, I don't think you would see that. I don't think you would see that in the records of people around the country. I mean, you look at Mr. Preet Bharara, for example, prosecuting Democrats and Republicans, not paying attention to which party people are members of. I think if the job is done right, and of course it's not always done right by prosecutors, we all know that, but if the job is done right, it's done correctly, it's done fairly, it's done justly, then I don't think that happens. Where I do think there are some policy differences is, for example, on whether mandatory minimums should be enforced in certain ways or in the way we think about jail sentences. In my own case, we started a federal prisoner reentry court in Newark 4 or 5 years ago to help men and women who were coming back from federal prison reintegrate into society. That was an affirmative programmatic policy decision that I made, but one that was similarly made by U.S. attorneys all across the country.
So what happens, just to press this point one step further and then we'll go on to other things, what happens in New Jersey when Trump appoints some my words, not yours, Jeff Sessions-style nationalist to do the job that you've done for the last 8 years with whatever you would describe your sensibilities to be? We know Sessions has already switched positions from Obama's Justice Department on transgender rights in one state, on the Texas voter ID race discrimination case, on enforcing oversight of problematic police departments like in Baltimore and Ferguson. So as concretely as you can, if a Jeff Sessions kind of guy becomes your successor, what are the implications for New Jersey?
Well, I think most of the docket of the U.S. Attorney's Office won't change very much at all. I mean, in my estimation, the issues that are most important for federal law enforcement to be dealing with in the District of New Jersey are national security, political corruption, cybercrime, healthcare fraud, economic fraud. Those are the things that occupy gangs. Those are the things that occupy the work of our office. It is the Attorney General has already said that he wants to make violent crime a priority. That may translate into the U.S. attorneys around the country reallocating some of their resources from other things to violent crime. We don't have In reality, no U.S. attorney, no U.S. attorney's office has sufficient resources to investigate or prosecute every federal crime, much less every significant federal crime.
So priorities
and so
matter.
Priorities and resource allocations matter. I expect there will be some direction from the attorney general about how those resources should be allocated. At the same time, Jeff Sessions was the U.S. attorney himself in Mobile, Alabama for 12 years when he was in the Reagan and Bush administration. I suspect, like most small district U.S. attorneys far away from Washington, didn't like so much interference from the mothership. And it's possible that he may, as part of his administration, give more discretion to the field. It's hard to know so far.
Yeah, and you mentioned anti-crime efforts getting a higher priority. I even noticed Sessions' statement upon asking for your and all the other U.S. attorneys' resignation was that your successors will continue to enforce the law. And the words enforce the law struck me because that makes the Justice Department seem like the law and order sheriff against street crime, when I think of the Justice Department more as seeking justice for all as the top line mission rather than enforcement as the first word. Maybe I just have a romantic notion, or do you think I'm reading something real into his language?
Well, I'm always reluctant to read things into other people's language. I can tell you how I thought of my job. The core mission of the U.S. Attorney's Office is to investigate and prosecute people who violate federal law. And, of course, we also have a civil mission where we represent the United States in civil litigation in federal court. But certainly in my experience in the 7.5 years I was U.S. attorney, we spent a lot of time – I personally spent a lot of time involved in – outward-facing issues dealing – so, for example, we spent a lot of time on reentry. I spent a lot of time over the last 4 or 5 years talking about the opioid epidemic. I spent a lot of time – I did grand rounds at almost all the hospitals in New Jersey to talk to doctors about that issue. I spent a lot of time on the Newark police investigation, which you will recall was the last time I was here. We talked about that.
Yes.
And about police reform. I spent a lot of time out in the community with the Arab and Muslim community and the African American community and the Hispanic community and the LGBT community, talking about the ways in which the Justice Department can and should protect them as part of our civil rights mission, ways in which we should make sure that they have an understanding of how to reach law enforcement, how to speak with law enforcement, where they can speak with law enforcement. And a lot of that was very productive and not only was good for those communities to make sure that they understood that they were protected and included, but also is good for law enforcement because when people feel like they have a relationship with law enforcement, then law enforcement does its job better.
Are you confident that the kinds of things you just described will continue?
I'm hopeful that they will because there are a lot of people in my office who are committed to that. There are a lot of people in law enforcement around New Jersey, and certainly it's a topic I will discuss with my successor whenever he or she is nominated.
Bonnie, on Staten Island, you're on WNYC with Paul Fishman, who for 8 years was the U.S. attorney for New Jersey until he, along with Preet Bharara and all the others, was asked to step down on Friday. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for this opportunity. I think that people misunderstand the point of this action. Some of it is emotional because it's a way of kind of getting back at the people that Trump and Trump's supporters have long held a grudge against. But this the point to asking all of these people to resign, and it isn't only in this office. It's also in other offices. I mean, Rex Tillerson has nobody under him, and nobody's been appointed under him. So he's got an empty shell. Who acts to do the things that have to get done when he goes abroad? We don't know. The point to all of this emptying out of the federal agencies is to disempower them, to cause dysfunction, to cause chaos. It's all part of Bannon's disempower the federal government.
Bonnie, I'm going to leave it there. Do you see any relationship potentially to the fact that a lot of the federal agencies under the executive branch have not been staffed up all that much? He mentions the State Department.
Right. The State Department, obviously, I don't know an awful lot about. I can see what's going on at the Justice Department. The nominees for the number two and number three positions had their confirmation hearings last week or earlier this week. I guess it was last week. And hopefully they will get confirmed soon if the Senate thinks that that's the right thing to do. But all the people below them and obviously all the U.S. attorney's jobs are now unfilled. There are – look, at least in my office, what I can tell you in my office, as I said it before, Bill Fitzpatrick, who was my first assistant, is also a career prosecutor and is a great guy. He's surrounded with the supervisors who are in that office who are all wonderful lawyers. The staff is terrific. I don't think our office is going to miss a beat in terms of pursuing investigations and prosecutions aggressively. But I do hope that if there are going to be nominees, that they come soon.
Both the U.S. attorneys and the FBI are under the Justice Department. Today, FBI Director James Comey is going to publicly confirm whether there's an official investigation into possible collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign. Do you have any knowledge of such an investigation?
I don't. Which is not to say that I would, so it doesn't mean – it just wouldn't necessarily have come within my purview.
So if there is an investigation of Trump and Russia underway, would it make it any harder in any way for Comey to get at the truth because 46 U.S. attorneys all had to suddenly resign last week?
I think that if – I know Jim Comey a long time, and I think if there's an investigation here to be done, then I'm confident that he will make sure that the FBI does what it needs to do in that investigation.
Reports during the campaign were that some dissident FBI staffers in the New York office were unhappy with Comey closing the Hillary Clinton email investigation last summer and would have leaked information about it in October if Comey hadn't revealed that he reopened the investigation a week before the election. The theory is that's why he went public with that very damaging disclosure that FBI directors usually keep confidential. Is that consistent with anything you think or know happened?
The answer is no. I don't know the answers to those questions.
That's it.
That's all I got to say.
Dimitri in Jersey City are on WNYC with Paul Fishman.
Hi. How are you doing? Hi, Mr. Fisher. I have one little comment. I know you lost your job, but there's going to be a big one opening soon. The governor's mentioned is going to be open in November. But my question for you is that I was wondering if you could go into a little detail into why you decided not to bring any charges against Chris Christie while you brought heavy charges against his people, and some of them are going to jail for doing something that many people believe that he had a heavy hand in participating into that bridge closure. I mean, did you not find anything that would prove that he was part of it, or you just decided not to bring charges against him?
So the only thing I'll say about that, because I've been very careful about how I've characterized our consideration of that case, and I've had many opportunities to talk about it, as you know, Brian. Our office brings cases when we have sufficient evidence to prove that someone is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. That is the standard to which we are held. So all I will say is, and I said it at the time of the original press conference, is that we brought charges against the people against whom we could prove beyond a reasonable doubt that they'd committed a crime. We tried that case. We were successful in front of the jury, and there's the evidence that came out at that trial. People can obviously read the transcripts. There were lots of people who attended that trial, both public and private, and people have to make their own conclusions about whether we made the right call or not.
Let me follow up on this question this way. There's been frustration expressed about Bridget Kelly and Bill Baroni being the only two people who faced jail time, that maybe they were successfully scapegoated by the people higher in power who you just couldn't find the smoking gun on. Do you think that's what happened?
Well, I'm not sure I'd adopt the word scapegoat. Our job in the U.S. Attorney's Office is to evaluate the evidence and figure out what it means. And as I put it at the press conference, there are five questions we asked. What happened? Who was responsible for what happened? Is it a federal crime? Can we prove it? And then the last question we always ask, literally in some way, should we make a federal case out of it? Is it something that should be prosecuted? As to those two people, we answered those questions, yes. We figured out what we thought happened, and we were able to prove that. It is not – without speculating about whether there were other people involved, whether other people should have been prosecuted or were responsible, or whether there was evidence against them, the one thing I will say is that sometimes in the criminal law, there are instances in which we are able to prove that certain people are responsible and we're not able to go further. It's not unique to corruption cases. It happens in drug cases. It happens in white collar crime cases, and we go as far as the evidence will take us in every case, and then make those decisions.
So there wasn't enough evidence to charge any others. But it seems clear from the reporting and the evidence at trial that Bill Stepien, once Christie's top political director and now at the White House, was involved in directing State House employees to punish Democratic mayors who didn't endorse the governor, and that attorneys at both the Port Authority and the State House, all allies of Governor Christie, were involved in coaching false testimony to the legislature in an attempt to cover up the scandal. What would you have needed to charge any of them of a crime related to those things?
Again, I'm not going to speculate about what I would have needed for any other individuals. I'm not sure that the way you characterized the evidence just now is entirely the way it came out at trial. All I'll say is that I'm confident that we handled the case as appropriately as we could. I'm confident that the people that we prosecuted were guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. That's why we took that case to a jury, and that's all I can say, I think, about that.
You said you were here last. You reminded me that you were here last to talk about the Newark police case, and Joe in Newark wants to ask a follow-up question about that. Joe, you're on WNYC with former U.S. Hey. Attorney Paul Fishman. Hi.
Hi, how you doing? I'm Joe from Newark, and I'm calling in. I wanted to really talk about neighborhood policing. WNYC even reported on how African-American males are more likely to be tried as adults than white male teenagers. And in the neighborhood in Newark, 95% of their arrests came from targeting loitering black males. This is not the neighborhood policing that we need to see some sort of increase in community values and togetherness.
Joe, thank you. If what he's saying is true, is there a U.S. attorney's role, a Justice Department role, in enforcing at least equal application of the law by race?
Absolutely. And it's why I and a number of people in my office and our colleagues in the Civil Rights Division in Washington spent so much time taking a deep dive into the way the Newark Police Department was doing its work. And as I said at the time, and I still believe it to be true, most of the men and women who wear that badge, who put on that uniform every morning, are incredibly dedicated public servants who took those jobs for the right reasons and want to protect public safety and want to make their communities better. But you have to have the right tools. You have to have the right training. You have to have the right resources to do that job well. And you have to have a culture that encourages people to behave in a particular way. What we found was that without figuring out whether there was an intent to discriminate or not, that the effect of the way the Newark Police Department was doing its work was having that kind of effect on the community. There were way too many people being stopped. Something like 75% of the people who were stopped on the street in Newark were stopped for a reason that was not a constitutional reason to stop them. They were being stopped, as Joe just said, for loitering and things like that. And it turned out that 85% of the people who were subject to those unconstitutional stops were African American. And so that more than suggested to us that there was a need for some change in the way Newark was policing. We also found that their internal affairs department was not doing its job and that these complaints were not being sustained.
So if not enough is changing, Joe alleges, what's the role of the Justice Department?
Well, so as a result of our investigation, we now have a court-enforceable consent decree that we signed with the city with a court-appointed monitor, Peter Harvey, who was the Attorney General of New Jersey about a decade ago. And the city has committed to, through that consent decree, to making major reforms. That's going to result in changes to the way Newark polices. There'll be more community policing. There'll be more officers on the street. They're going to have much better training in when they can stop people and why they can stop people and when they arrest somebody, how those people should be treated. But I would like to tell Joe it could all change overnight. It's not going to change overnight. It's going to be at least a 5-year time horizon, I think, to get all these changes in place in a way that are not only visible but sustainable. And I encourage Joe, if he's seeing things that he doesn't like, seeing things that he doesn't think the police are behaving the way they should, he should pick up the phone, call the monitor, and I guarantee you that he will have a voice. Everyone in the community, there's a community survey going on right now in the city being administered by the monitor, and the Justice Department, my office, will be involved throughout the period of the consent decree.
Can Jeff Sessions replace that monitor with a different individual?
The monitor was appointed by a district court judge. And so the answer to that question is no. And I've seen in the press that the Attorney General is not so enthusiastic necessarily about continuing these kinds of investigations in the future,
Oversight of police departments in particular.
Right, oversight of police departments in particular. I have every confidence that because there's a consent decree in place, it's being overseen by not just a monitor but by a federal judge, that the reforms in Newark will be accomplished over the period of time that we envisioned.
I hope so. One last content area. As you leave a corruption-fighting job, which is part of what U.S. Attorney certainly does, in a state famous for its corruption, why is there so much corruption in New Jersey? What conclusions have you come to after 8 years of this, and what still needs to be changed to clean it up?
So I can't compare whether there's more corruption in New Jersey to other places. What I can say is that one thing that we do in New Jersey that other states don't necessarily do is prioritize it as a prosecutive matter. So, for example, in our office for the last 50 years, we've had a standalone corruption division with about 10% of the office's staff. At least that's how I've staffed it, with 10% of the office's lawyers. And that is a huge priority for us. People who are in public service like I was, and I did it not just for the 8 years I was U.S. attorney, but for 14 years before that. So 22 years of the 33 I've been practicing law. I have a huge dedication to and passion for public service, as do the people that I work with every day. The people in my office were amazing public servants. It is all too frequent now that people in public life are denigrating the value of public service, running down the government. And the result of that is a lack of confidence and a lack of integrity, lack of confidence in the integrity of the people who work for the government. When people get caught doing public corruption, when people are on the take and people know and they're not being prosecuted, that undermines the fabric of public service and government and causes people to lose that confidence they should have. So that's why we take it so seriously. Now, I would also say there are 566 towns in New Jersey and even more school districts than that. And so there are a lot of people in public life, and that obviously is an opportunity to do that. I'm not going to say most of those people by a lot, you know, are wonderful public servants, but there is a temptation and there is an opportunity. And my view is that the federal government has a huge role to play in making sure that that doesn't happen.
There's an obligatory end of interview question that people in my position usually ask at this point before you go, but I'm going to let Mendez in Newark ask his version of it since we've got him. Mendez, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning, Attorney Fisher. You give a great lecture here at the medical school, Rutgers, I believe last year. My question, though, is you considering running for governor? If you are, not only I'll be working on your campaign, you will also have my vote and others. Would you considering it?
I am not considering running for public office, and for a couple of reasons. One is it's just not the job for me, I think. But also, I think it's a little risky sometimes when people who have these jobs are perceived to be doing these jobs because they have their eye on the next job. I don't want the people who are prosecutors, particularly who are U.S. attorneys, necessarily to be second-guessed about the decisions they made, the cases they investigated, the people they tried, because they thought it might be politically advantageous to them. These jobs are hard enough. The decisions we had to make are difficult enough. The impact that even serving a subpoena on someone or searching their house especially or an arrest can have on people's lives is so profound and so dramatic that I think it's critically important that the people who do this work, conscious of the power and responsibility that they have, do it in a way that gives people confidence that the only reason they're doing it is because they believe in the mission.
But are you saying that U.S. attorneys, therefore, should never run for elected office afterwards? We know, obviously, Chris Christie did. There's so much speculation now that that's what Preet Bharara will do next. Do you think anybody in your position should rule it out?
It's just the way I think of my own job. I don't, you know, people have to make their own decisions about what they do. And there are obviously some people who were U.S. attorneys in the past who've turned into fabulous public elected officials. But that's just the way I think about it for myself.
So what are you going to do next?
So I'm going to take the next several weeks and try to sort that out. I'm not worried about my future. Obviously, these jobs have prepared – this job has prepared me in a lot of ways to do a lot of different things. I've had experience running an organization of 300 people with a $35 million budget. I've had difficult personnel decisions, crisis management, making hard calls that affect people's lives, being involved in cases that are in the corporate world and the healthcare world. And so there are a lot of things that would be interesting to me, but I'm going to spend the next few weeks, maybe the next several weeks, trying to sort that out.
Paul Fishman, the precipitously former U.S. attorney for New Jersey, thank you so much for coming across the river and doing this in person. We really appreciate it. Our listeners really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we will talk about what you might call the progressive secession movement known as Blue Exit. Stay with us.